Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Our speaker is widely respected scholar of German idealism and a leader in modern Jewish philosophy, Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture is titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The French Connection. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Michael Zank, professor of religion and acting director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Miriam Bienenstock to Boston and to the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. I first became aware of Miriam Bienenstock's work on Hegel many years ago, in 1986 or so, when I was working on my master's thesis on Franz Rosenzweig and in Heidelberg. And I noted the name, which is a beautiful name, and it was a few years later then that I had the chance to meet Professor Bienenstock, and we have been in, conversing in many contexts. And the reason why it was almost inevitable to meet Miriam in one or another context is because she has been extremely, extremely productive, and not just in terms of her own research on Hegel, whom I already mentioned, but German idealism more generally, as well as Franz Rosenzweig and other German Jewish thinkers. But she also was involved in the organization of conferences and meetings over the last 15 years or so that brought together scholars from international institutions, universities from across Europe, and really the globe around issues of German idealism and Jewish thought. Professor Bienenstock received her PhD in 1975 from Lyon in France. She then served as a lecturer in philosophy at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem from 1977 to 1986. She told me today that in those years she did not produce much writing, publications, and so forth, and it was mostly due to the influence of her husband, Norbert Vasek, who is also with us tonight, that she felt compelled to produce, and produce she did. Not only did she subsequently hold professorships and lectureships at various places, including Grenoble, Tours, where she is now, but also guest professorships in Frankfurt, in Zurich, and other places, but she produced an enormous range of writing. Aside from all the organizational work she's done, she's published almost a dozen books and more than 90 scholarly papers on a wide range of topics. Outstanding among these topics, always issues of German idealism and its practical relevance, its political and practical horizons. Most recently, Miriam has worked on questions of history and the concept of history, which still haunts us in the European tradition, and the work is also increasingly appreciated, I believe, here in the United States. Miriam also is the immediate past president of the International Franz Rosenzweig Society, where she was able to bring together and to engage in productive work very different scholars from different backgrounds, not just in terms of educational and research, but also from different, really from all continents and their contexts. And that's not an easy thing to do, because as you can imagine, if you're a member of a professional society that has, I don't know how many hundred members from so many different contexts, to get these people to work together, to publish together, and to feel engaged as they have been over these past few years and not get disgruntled and unhappy. It was largely due to the character of and the style of Miriam Bienenstock, who is, as you will see, fairly soft-spoken, but very decisive in what she says. And this has served her well in the capacity of bringing together scholars and getting things done.
It's a great pleasure for me to be here. It is in English that I'm going to speak on Levinas, which is somewhat unusual for me. Levinas having written all his works in French, never in any other language, as far as I could gather. And French is much more congenial to me, since it is my native language. But even if Levinas did write in French, it is not sure that one understands him better when one reads him in French. His case is not similar to that of many other philosophers, German ones for that matter, Hegel, also Kant, who definitely require to be read in German, if only because they are extremely difficult to translate into any other language. With Levinas, what is one translating from? Only from French? That would not be enough. Many of Levinas' sources were German, some also Hebrew, and maybe a little bit of Aramaic for the Mishnah and the Talmud. And he himself spoke Russian. If one wants to translate Levinas, one ought to translate from these languages too. For it quite frequently is the case that the terms Levinas uses are, on the face of it, French words. He writes in French, yet originally Hebrew, or for that matter, German ones. Levinas himself translated them into French without, however, making his practice explicit, which entails that sometimes when his text has been translated back into German or into Hebrew, the translator did not realize that he or she was retranslating into German or into Hebrew terms which were originally thought of in those languages. That Levinas did write in French does not mean that he thought in French. What is the language in which Levinas thought? But, you'll ask, is there a language in which one thinks? The question might not be accepted, in any case, not by everybody. Isn't thinking universal beyond any and every particular language? Without engaging here into a reflection on this difficult philosophical issue, let me point out that even those who do not consider the question appropriate in general should admit its legitimacy in the case of Levinas. French was not his native language, and many of his sources and the authors upon whom he wrote had not written in French or in a Latin language. Levinas read them in their original language, not in translation. He kept thinking about the original words, even if he did not explicitly say so. He actually took great pains at separating, should I say, segregating his Jewish teaching and the Jewish sources which he used from his philosophical writing as such and in his teaching. He went quite far, frequently, at hiding his Jewish sources, also the Hebrew origin of some of his basic concepts from the common reader, and more particularly the philosopher. I think we'll have occasion to give examples of that. Levinas is not the only Jewish thinker or philosopher who behaved in that way. Others behaved similarly for similar or different reasons. And I'll just give one example out of many, that of Fackenheim, who spoke of his two hats, the kippah of the rabbi and the mortarboard or graduation cap of the philosopher. whatever their reasons were, and they would need to be commented upon, the practice certainly does not render their texts easy to understand. It explains why, in the case of Levinas, it is not enough to translate in whichever language it could be, and also why reading Levinas in French is not enough, a point my French students would confirm. Some of the most brilliant ones do not follow him, also in French, and they very frequently despair. For us to understand Levinas, we need not just a translation, but also a clarification of his language and of the context, or rather the several different contexts in which his thinking developed. It is not by accident that I have chosen the expression French connection as a title for this lecture. I'm quite aware of the fact that the term once famously referred to a movie on a drug traffic. And it is a kind of drug to which I am referring. A French drug, philosophical one, which was widespread in Levinas's time and still is today, very much so, in fact. My assertion will be that Levinas has counted amongst those who, particularly amongst the philosophers, paid a tribute to that drug, but that he also resisted it forcefully. That context of Levinas's philosophy, to which I have referred by the term French connection, is not, seems to me, as belabored as the two other connections or contexts of his philosophical thought, one of the reasons being that much, too much, is taken for granted, erroneously. Quite often, we, French and non-French readers alike, do not know or do not remember anymore that which at the time was well known and should still be. Here is another Hegelian saying which accounts for much of my practice today, saying that something, a proposition, a matter of fact, is well known, bekannt, does not necessarily mean that it is known or understood or erkannt. Mostly it is not the case. I reckon that speaking, as I have done it, about a French connection, the drug traffic might seem quite extreme. Other commentators, philosophers who presented the French context in and out of which Levinas developed his thinking, have been more cautious. Vincent Descombes, for example, a French colleague of mine, my contemporary rather than one of Levinas, who begins his modern French philosophy by asking, somewhat ironically, can the color of time be described? Who could say what the atmosphere of a period was? Vincent Descombes' little book was published more than 30 years ago, yet I highly recommend reading it also today. Descombes is today in France one of our best philosophers, and his work is not only very enlightening, it also is quite entertaining and relevant to my query, even if, surprisingly enough, for us at least, the name of Levinas appears in it only once, on a page which deals with Derrida. It's a kind of footnote to Derrida. Was Levinas too well known to need a presentation? Or would he rather not have been known, not known at all at the time? Descombes himself provides an answer, albeit partial, to that question when he explains what he intended to perform in his book. He wants, I quote, to introduce the reader to that which was spoken about in a given territory and during a given period. And then he adds that such a clamorous approach, cette approche bruyante de la philosophie, is necessarily unjust, since, I quote, it leaves aside whatever, though sometimes worthy of attention, has gone ignored by the public or has not received attention to a sufficient degree. One page later, Descombes calls Maurice Blanchot to the witness box, a friend of Levinas, whose name does appear quite often in Descombes' book, unlike that of Levinas. And this is the quotation. It should not be believed that the authority a work may carry is the result of its having been read, studied, and finally judged convincing. The reverse is true. Reading derives from a prior conviction. Works are preceded by rumor, la rumeur. As Maurice Blanchot wrote, public opinion is never more purely opinion than where rumor is concerned. Opinion is, for instance, that's Blanchot, what can be read in the newspapers, but never in this or that in particular. Such is precisely the essence of rumor, since, quote, what I learned from rumor I have necessarily heard already. So here one finds the beginning of an answer to the question, why? Why did Descombes refrain from treating Levinas more fully in his book? In all those years, from 1933 to 1978, nobody spoke about Levinas in France. Rumor did not propagate his ideas. At the time, Blanchot was spoken about, not Levinas. In 1991, about 10 years later, another little book was published as a kind of postscriptum to the talented retrospective of Vincent Descombes. That book was entitled Le tournant théologique de la phénoménologie française by Dominique Janicot, The Theological Turn of French Phenomenology. That book started from Levinas. Right at the start, many authors were also mentioned who are strongly indebted to Levinas. Jacques Derrida, already central in Descombes' book, also Paul Ricoeur, Jean-Luc Marion, and many others. Rumor seemed to have gotten hold of Levinas at long last. There also was quite a debate in France, one which is not over yet, about the issues raised in that second book. It is highly critical of the so-called theological turn and of the unfaithfulness to phenomenology the authors I have just mentioned are found guilty of. As a matter of fact, the book focuses almost exclusively upon phenomenology and its reception in France. This is the perspective on the basis of which Levinas is best understood. I do not think so. I rather consider it as inadequate, also when the discussion is about the German connection of Levinas. The best way to understand Levinas, to clarify his thinking and what he wanted to achieve in his books, is certainly not to ask if he was a good phenomenologist, French or German. We should replace him in another setting, one to which, by the way, Derrida himself seemed to testify when he wrote in the texts quoted by Vincent Descombes that the only language of Western philosophy is the language of totality, and that in such a language, that of Hegelianism, one cannot but, here is Derrida, repeat Hegelianism, which is only this language coming into absolute possession of itself. Would Hegelianism be the drug, then? That drug to which Levinas could not but pay a tribute and to which he, in the end, fell prey, as Derrida claimed. No. The drug I have been talking about, the drug Levinas reacted to was not Hegelianism. It was distinctly French, in a limited sense, though, since it bore a Russian, yet Frenchified name, that of Alexandre Kojève. The name of Kojève is rarely mentioned by Levinas, but Kojève is there, all right, in his books. It is Alexandre Kojève who stands at the center of the French connection necessary for understanding Levinas. Let me make myself very clear here, for the risk of being misunderstood is great and only too common. If Alexandre Kojève and his Parisian lectures on Hegel's phenomenology of spirit stand at the center of the French connection necessary for understanding Levinas, this is not because Levinas would have drawn his ideas from Kojève, or because he would have been drugged by Kojève. This is because Levinas was not drugged, because he resisted the drug so many of his contemporaries accepted. He did not accept Kojève's grand theses. He opposed them. And his importance, the importance of Levinas, comes partly, to be sure, not only from that, but also from that, from his stubborn resistance to those ideas which were à la mode, fashionable at the time. This point is very useful to keep in mind if one wants to understand his thought, or for that matter, many other systems of thought. When one finds a philosopher difficult to understand, I think one should try to find his adversaries, the philosophers he objected to, the living ones, not the dead ones, identifying those with whom he disagreed and the ideas he wanted to fight will make it much easier to understand his own ideas, his own way of thinking. What Kojève said is very well known by Kant, and yet it is not known by Kant. The meaning and implications of his thesis are rarely, if ever, made explicit. In any case, they practically never are when Levinas's ideas are discussed, and that's a pity. Although Kojève is very well known, let me first say a few words on this charismatic personality who came from Russia, like Levinas, who had come from Lithuania, a part of the Russian Empire since the end of the 18th century. Kojève had studied philosophy in Germany, in Berlin, where, by the way, he began and later developed a close lifelong friendship with Leo Strauss. Kojève also went to Heidelberg, where he wrote a thesis on the philosophy of religion, but he never was just a philosopher, if I may say so. He was something else and much more, which shows through the fact that after World War II, he spent many years, many more than the years during which he had been teaching philosophy, working in the French Ministry of Economic Affairs, where he became one of the chief planners of the European Common Market. Indeed, it is almost by accident that he became famous as a philosopher and as a Hegelian, for that matter, translating and explaining that abstruse work of Hegel's called the Phenomenology of Spirit. Almost by accident, because Kojève had no real job or position in Paris. He owed the opportunity of lecturing to a fellow Russian emigrate by the name of Alexandre Coiré, who did have a job but wanted to leave Paris, and asked him to replace him at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, quite a prestigious institution. And I quote, "From that time on, we have breathed Kojève's teaching with the air of the times," unquote. This is what Alan Bloom writes in the introduction to the English translation of Kojève's text. Alan Bloom, whose name many will know here in the US, was sent to Paris by Leo Strauss and spent some time in Paris, listened to Kojève, and then decided to translate into English the lectures on Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit Kojève had given in Paris in the 30s. The audience was not large. Aaron's autobiography mentions about 20 people. According to Raymond Paulin, there were even less. See, there are many more here. But one could find there almost everybody who would soon count in town. Not just philosophers, also men of letters, and a few women, not many. The list of great names, names of people who, however, only became famous later on, is impressive. Besides Levinas, who did go, although irregularly, and his name is not often mentioned in that context, there were writers like Raymond Queneau and Georges Bataille or Pierre Klossowski, writer as well as a philosopher. Philosophers like Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Raymond Paulin, Eric Weil, political scientists or future ones, Raymond Aron for one, philosophers, psychoanalysts like Jacques Lacan, also at least one Jesuit, Gaston Fessard. Sartre was in Berlin. He didn't go himself, but Raymond Aron and Simone de Beauvoir did and reported to him. And that was the drug. Here it is. The drug had to do with Hegel, but it was not really Hegel whom Kojève presented, even if he said so. And if he said it in a grand way, he claimed that he was translating. See how dangerous it is to say that when one translates. He claimed that he was translating into French, word for word, Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. At the time, the book had not yet been translated into French. Translations were still to come, some in the wake of Kojève's lectures. Hippolyte, for example, who attended Kojève's classes, translated later on. And Kojève knew German very well, certainly much better than some of those who later on retranslated the Phenomenology into French. Even if Kojève translated Hegel and lectured on Hegel, it was not Hegel whom he presented, and not Hegel's ideas, rather his own. Considering the success they had, and still have today, in France and elsewhere, one may wonder if it would not be better to stick to them and read him instead of trying to go back to that abstruse, old-fashioned 19th century Hegel who has been dead for centuries. Some would say that indeed it is not necessary. Many still think so today, also in France. Perhaps even some amongst the greatest Hegel specialists, although they do not dare to say it aloud. I am not convinced. I think that the distance is momentous between Hegel and Kojève, but I shall not go on explaining why, in any case not today. However that may be, as I said, it is usually not against dead adversaries, but against living ones, contemporaries, that we rebel. Levinas rebelled against Kojève and against the ideas Kojève stood for, because those were the ideas which drugged, philosophically speaking, his contemporaries. So Levinas was some sort of rebellious. But there always is a drawback, a limitation to being a rebel. Whenever Kojève is mentioned today, particularly here in the US, this is most often in connection with Fukuyama's book, The End of History and the Last Man, a book whose main thesis did draw on Kojève, who had insisted that in Hegel there would have been an end of history. For Hegel and for all the followers of Hegel, history would be completed and nothing really new could again really happen. On history and on the end of history, Levinas does have a quarrel with Hegel, or rather with Kojève's Hegel. But his rebellion against Kojève's Hegel went much farther than the end of history thesis, much farther than the Kojèvian conception of totality. It is against Kojève's very way of understanding philosophy that he rebelled, and also against Kojève's basic concepts. Let's take the first one, mentioned right at the beginning of Levinas's Totality and Infinity, and right at the beginning of Kojève's lectures, the concept of desire. No, that's the French connection. Desire. I quote Kojève, "The human eye is the eye of a desire or of desire. The very being of man, the self-conscious being, therefore implies and presupposes desire." This is what Kojève said. And what is desire? According to Kojève, well, desire, according to Kojève, is negation. It's very simple. With Kojève, things are very simple, but he is a great seductor. Un séducteur. Negation. For Kojève, desire is negation. It consists in acting to negate whatever is other, whatever is different. It consists in acting to assimilate the other reality, whichever it is, human, non-human, assimilate that to oneself. I quote Kojève, "The being that eats, for example, creates and preserves its own reality by the overcoming of a reality other than its own, by the transformation of an alien reality into its own reality, by the assimilation, the internalization of a foreign external reality. Generally speaking, the eye of desire is an emptiness that receives a real positive content only by negating action that satisfies desire in destroying, transforming, and assimilating the desired non-I. Desire, according to Kojève, is negation of the other, assimilation of the other, l'autre. The other reality, negated by my desire, may be any or everything. It may be an inanimate reality, the one which could become food for me, for example, but it may also be a living human being. And according to Kojève, this would make a difference, a huge difference, because here is another basic thesis of his. I quote, "The positive content of the I constituted by negation is a function of the positive content of the negated non-I. If, then, the desire is directed towards a natural non-I, the I, too, will be natural. The I created by the active satisfaction of such a desire will have the same nature as the things toward which that desire is directed. It will be a thingish I, a merely living I, an animal I. If you only think about eating, then you'll eat and you'll negate the food, which is the outside, but you'll only be an animal I. If, on the other hand, you desire an object which is not a natural one, if you desire not just food, but another desire as such, the desire of another human being, in that case, by satisfying this desire, you too might become something else than a thingish I. You might become a true human being." I quote, "Desire directed towards another desire taken as desire will create, by the negating and assimilating action that satisfies it, an I essentially different from the animal I. This I, which feeds on desires, will itself be desire in its very being, created in and by the satisfaction of its desire." Kojève sets here the stage for that which is called, up to this day, struggle for recognition, the fight to death for recognition. Man, or rather the human being, would be moved by a desire for recognition. he would be ready to risk his life for the sake of recognition. Kojève argues that he draws this conception from Hegel, and indeed, up to this day, many commentators of Hegel follow this lead, particularly in France, but not just in France, also in Germany and in other countries. I could give you many eloquent examples drawn from today's philosophical life in France, which can also be spotted in other countries and in Germany, of the fashion or of that which I have called the drug which consists in starting and ending with the so-called fight for recognition. Where does it come from? From there. One does find in Hegel some pages devoted to the fight for recognition, and yet I do not believe the reading of Kojève, or for that matter, the reading of anybody who puts the fight for recognition at the center, to be true to the teaching of Hegel. That which is important to me and to all those who would like to understand Levinas is to show that Levinas objected, A, to Kojève's and to what he believed to be Hegel's understanding of the struggle for recognition, and also B, more fundamentally, to Kojève's conception of desire, and even C, and this is even more important, to the philosophical framework which underpins that reading. Levinas argues, you read Totality and Infinity, the beginning of Totality and Infinity, he argues that Kojève and all those who were or are enthusiastic about Kojève have understood nothing of the reality of desire. They turn it into an attempt at negating that which is other, l'autre, at assimilating that other, the other reality, also the other individual, to ourselves, to something which would be the same as us, or even directly us, as in the case of food, for example. They thus use the model, the paradigm of food, to understand the nature of desire, assimilating another inanimate reality in order to nourish ourselves. And they understand the relation to the other individual, man or woman, according to the same assimilating paradigm, le même et l'autre. This is the title of Levinas' first part in Totality and Infinity. This, Levinas says, might perhaps account for our needs, the needs we have as biological entities, the need for food, for sex, or for a place in the sun, ma place au soleil, you know. We do have needs. Levinas fully acknowledges this human situation, but he contests that desire with a capital letter. And Levinas's use of the capital also comes from Kojève. With Levinas, you'll see, he talks about desire with a capital D. That's Kojève. But he negates Kojève. He says it's just the reverse form of Kojève. Desire does not consist in the negation and assimilation. The assimilation of that which is other, l'autre, to the same. According to Levinas, desire rather is a desire for the invisible. This is what it would mean to desire, desiring. So first he puts emphasis upon desire that comes from Kojève, but then he says it's something completely different than that which Kojève had said. In our desire, we are turned towards the other, turned towards the elsewhere and the otherwise. These are the first words of the first chapter of Totality and Infinity, a chapter which is entitled Métaphysique et Transcendance and subtitled Désir de l'invisible, Desire for the Invisible, and which begins with La vraie vie est absente, the true life is absent. It is the French poet Arthur Rimbaud in Une saison en enfer, whom Levinas quotes here. The true life is absent. We are not in this world. We do not belong to the world. But Levinas modifies the text. Mais nous sommes au monde. But we are in, at the world. There appears already here. But Levinas goes on, writing that the customary analysis of desire cannot explain away the singular pretension of that which he calls metaphysical desire, a desire which, I quote, tends towards something entirely, something else entirely, towards the absolute, absolutely other. Le désir métaphysique tend vers toute autre chose, vers l'absolument autre. That's something else. One may wonder and ask, what is a metaphysical desire? What could that mean? And one should remember, always keep in mind, that the term metaphysics is a polemical one, a word which has been at the center of polemics at least since the beginning of the 19th century after Kant. In fact, already earlier on, but let's talk about that. At the time, it was rejected in the name of positivism. A positivism which was then presented as an empiricism and as a scientific view. Things had changed in Levinas's time. That which mattered then was the discussion with phenomenology. But this latter trend of thought also presented itself as one opposed to metaphysics, as an immanent philosophy, one which wanted to go back to the chose même, this time not empirically understood. However that may be, the term metaphysics was not liked either. It still was a highly polemical word. Has the situation changed today? In a sense, yes. Many, at least in Europe, maybe not here, in France, in any case, also in Germany, do talk about a return to metaphysics and wonder whether or not we are living in a post-metaphysical age. But the context remains a highly polemical one. You just need to think about the book by Jürgen Habermas, which bears that title. Whatever the answer is today, the age of Levinas himself was doubtlessly oriented against metaphysics. In an anti-metaphysical age, it needs much courage and a great force of character to proclaim, as Levinas did, that one should rehabilitate metaphysics. One knows his proclamation, again, directly at the beginning of Totality and Infinity. To die for the invisible, this is metaphysics. Folle prétention à l'invisible, demented pretension to the invisible, when the acute experience of the human in the 20th century teaches that the thoughts of men are born by needs which explain society and history, that hunger and fear can prevail over every human resistance and every freedom. In such a rehabilitation of metaphysics, Levinas succeeded, at least partially. He was most certainly one of the main actors in changing the air or the color of times and introducing what came to be called the theological turn. But recognition came slowly, as it were. This may account, in any case, partially, for the almost total absence of the name of Levinas in the book of Vincent Descombes. How, indeed, could he expect any understanding, Levinas, I mean, any understanding in the 60s, when Totality and Infinity was published, for a notion like that of metaphysical desire? The notion of desire is an ancient one, one which has a very long philosophical history. And that history does not begin with Kojève, or even with Hegel. What was, by the way, the German word Hegel had used for desire? Was it Begierde, or would it rather be Trieb? The pulsion or impulsion Freud would deal with 100 years later. Levinas, writing about desire, was in any case not reading Hegel himself. He rather thought about Kojève reading Hegel, and he was writing against him or against both. He might also have thought about other terms or ideas in other languages, made to correspond to the French word désir. He quotes none, though. Segregation. He chooses to refer to Plato. Plato, who had described what he had called eros. Religion is desire, with the capital D, and not struggle for recognition. Here we are. Religion is desire. Desire with a capital D, just like Kojève, but without the meaning ascribed to it by Kojève. What an extraordinary reversal. Levinas does not understand desire as the assimilation of the other to the same, as the recognition of the other as being the same, the identical, but as acknowledgement of the other as other. Religion is desire and not struggle for recognition. This is the acknowledgement of that which Levinas calls transcendance. The third section of the first part, whose title I have already quoted, Metaphysics and Transcendence, bears the title La transcendance n'est pas la négativité. Transcendence is not negativity. No. When Levinas writes and repeats that metaphysics does not coincide with negativity, it is once again Kojève whom he is countering, already in the first pages of his Hegel commentary, and then throughout his lectures, Kojève had ascribed a primary importance to the notion of negativity, arguing that all action is negating, etc., etc. But we should now pay attention to the title, the very title of Levinas's first great book, his PhD thesis, Totality and Infinity. The title calls for two remarks. One, Levinas did choose to retain the term of totality. Contrarily to what is often believed, he did not reject it. Second remark, Levinas wrote totality and infinity. He did not intend to replace the notion of totality with that of infinity. He rather added to it, associated it by means of an and to that of infinity. But that's what he called metaphysics. And I'm going to not to quote that. He says that the description of that relation is that which he calls metaphysics, and it is the central issue of his research. To grasp what is called desire, or again, metaphysical desire, Levinas reaches beyond Kojève and his flat, superficial understanding of Hegel. He resorts to other sources. One of them is Plato, whom I have already quoted. Others are German, and the main one is most certainly Jewish, even if he refrains from saying so. Today, I limit myself, French connection oblige, to the French sources. Descartes should be mentioned first because he is explicitly quoted. Descartes, who had put forward in his metaphysical meditations the idea of the primacy of the perfect over the imperfect. Levinas also invokes Maurice Blanchot and his text, published in 1952, La Mort Possible. Behind Blanchot and Blanchot on Death, there was, once again, Kojève, I think. Kojève and the mixture, the drug concocted for the French with the help of texts borrowed from German authors, Hegel, Nietzsche, and Heidegger. Blanchot had written that the work of those three authors would consist in, I quote, attempts at making death possible. And Levinas did comment many times on that existentialist reading, which indeed put emphasis upon death taken as negativity. Levinas proceeded in that manner in order to distance himself from such a reading. He also resorted to Blanchot in order, I think, in order to cut himself off from Heidegger and from notions like that of the Ilia, which would otherwise have been related to Heidegger. But Blanchot, whom he had met already in Strasbourg before the war and with whom he remained friendly all his life, in spite of the distance in their political convictions, seems to have meant much more to him than had he merely been the source of cogent philosophical concepts or arguments. Levinas once said that to him, Blanchot was comme l'expression même de l'excellence française, the very expression of French excellence. That is, French excellence and not French connection. What did he mean by that? Question mark. Thank you for your attention.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture was titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The French Connection, and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Michael Zank, professor of religion and acting director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.